Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, and as you might come to have expected, producer Manny is joining me here today. Welcome back, producer Manny.
Hey, good to be back, everybody.
Although I'd argue that if anybody like never left, it'd be you. You've been here the whole time. Like I get here, the audience gets here, we all arrive, but you're already kind of here if you think about it.
You're not wrong. Even in the episodes that I'm not on camera for, I'm still here in the background.
It's nice for those that listened to the last episode, my voice was just about completely gone. So welcome back my voice. And it's nice to have it back because we're going to need it today because we're digging into the top stories in digital publishing and the advertising industry. And starting at the top, we've got who else but Google. Google in the news, as we've come to expect. And Google's they always say Google Boss. I don't know, for whatever reason, Google Boss is always used in headlines over Google CEO, who is Sundar Pichai, who is basically defending now the Apple search deal, which we talked a little bit about in some prior episodes. But before we kind of dig into that, producer Manny, what's the latest?
So yeah, we had a pivotal moment in the US versus Google antitrust trial. Google CEO Sundar Pichai took the stand to defend the tech giant's dominance in the search market, facing allegations of maintaining market control through payments to rivals like Apple. Pichai argued that Google's investments, particularly in Chrome, have significantly enhanced user experience, naturally leading to an increase in Google searches. Despite the staggering $26.3 billion spent in 2021 to secure the position as the default search engine with Apple, Pichai justified the expenditure as a competitive necessity in a market where Apple controls both hardware and software. And the high stakes of this legal battle not only scrutinized Google's business practices, but also set the stage for a potential seismic shift in the search industry landscape. So it's interesting to see that he's going as far as to defend it, saying like, well, Apple controls hardware and software, so we needed to make this investment so that everyone else's life got easier by using Google search.
Yeah, it's kind of like whenever, I remember being a kid and telling my mom and dad that I need something. I need those new clothes. I need those new shoes. Like, it's going to make me look so much cooler. Like, all the other kids have it. Like, it's ridiculous to think that these things aren't necessary. And I think it's a really, in a fair way, I would say that there's a lot that Google has done to add value and make us like build the roads that we all drive on for the web. And especially in our space, when you think about something like search, if there was no, you know, dominant search engine, it might make it a lot harder for independent publishers to basically grow a following, grow an audience. You could say the same thing about advertising. You'd say the same thing about browsing the web. I've heard before from good developers that the hardest thing in the world to build is a browser. And if you know even just a little bit about programming languages, you would know that there are thousands of them, and the web has very few open standards, and they're all just hacked up because people figure out what they can do, and then it's up to the browser in real time to try to, you know, adapt and support those things. And people are always building stuff, and it's impossible to keep up. So Chrome is quite a incredible feat, and it's open source. So there's a lot Google has done that you can give them credit for that make the web better. Now, that being said, it still doesn't change the fact that you do certain things because it's anti-competitive. It's like, okay, you made user experience better for users, or you made users prefer Google search. Well, like, maybe somebody else could have made the exact same thing. Right? I mean, am I crazy here? Producer Manny, is it outside the realm of possibility that anybody else could have hired those engineers, could have built a search engine, could have, you know, innovated in the way that Google did? Did Google have to be the one that made this? Did they have to be the ones that, you know, did this deal with Apple? Because, you know, like, feels like manifest destiny, for those that are familiar with Western history.
It does feel a little bit like manifest destiny. And I think it's one of those things where I think Microsoft could have done it, but if you look back, you know, 10 years or so, could you see yourself using Internet Explorer on your mobile?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because it's like you have to kind of base, it's like you're rewriting history and you're imagining this alternative future. I'm trying to think the name of the, I think it's, maybe it's Huxley. It's not Brave New World. The one where they have the alternate history where the Axis won World War II. Do you know what book I'm talking about?
I remember the Netflix series. Something, I think.
Yeah, Man something in the Castle. High Castle.
Man in the High Castle?
Yeah, Man in the High Castle. That's what it was. Where it's like, it's an interesting thought experiment, but yeah, it's almost impossible to imagine because we took a different fork in history. And I think that that's going to be the real challenge that legislators have in all of these various antitrust lawsuits, which the longer they drag out, the more it favors big tech, because the public sentiment, the economic conditions, the political will, all these things sort of like they fluctuate throughout time. And big tech, their perspective is unwavering, right? Like the executives, the people, the decisions, like those things are all going to stay pretty much the same. The politicians, the, you know, the economy, you know, like if the, you know, U.S. goes into a recession, is the U.S. going to want to basically like hamstring one of their, you know, strongest GDP contributors? Maybe not, you know, so it's always in their best interest to just keep extending this thing out. And it's starting to get a little bit of that flavor to it. But I think that all of this stuff does sort of have a revisionist history component to it. And you're going to have to keep sort of like the defense, which is big tech, from basically claiming like, look, you can look into the past and say, you know, attribute all kinds of motivations to these decisions, but these were just good business decisions. And I think that's not necessarily, I think that that's a pretty far reach in some of these respects. But yeah, the longer it goes on, I would say the larger the chance of something like that happening and very little being done outside of, you know, something maybe that makes headlines and makes everybody feel like it wasn't a huge waste of money.
Definitely. And we're still expected to see a decision from the U.S. court system in early 2024. So we'll just have to wait and see. We'll wait and see. Moving on to some social media news. In a surprising turn of events in the social media landscape, Elon Musk's platform X, formerly known as Twitter, is facing significant challenges in user retention and revenue generation. Since Musk's takeover of X, it's witnessed a loss of nearly 15 million users, with a notable 16% decline in daily active users on the mobile app. The platform's primary revenue source, advertising, has also taken a hit, with brands returning but not spending as much as they did before. Which I know that that's you know, here and there, because I know the ad revenue space has also been fluctuating a lot. But regardless, X's valuation has plummeted from $44 billion to $19 billion over the past year. And amidst these struggles, Musk envisions transforming X into an all-in-one financial center and a full-fledged dating site by 2024. That's a quote.
Yeah.
He wants to turn it into a bit of everything, kind of like what Facebook is doing internationally with trying to create their own currency system. He has the same similar vision. Additionally, despite facing a significant decline in active users, the social media app formerly known as Twitter is proving to be more resilient than initially thought. Recent reports indicate that the 16% drop in daily active users since May has also seen a daily time spent per user falling by 2% year over year. However, since in the United States, the power users, being a lot of politicians, celebrities, still remain deeply engaged, spending an average of 20 minutes per day on the platform as of September 2023. This stickiness factor has posed a challenge for competitors like rival Threads and startup Pebble, who has now shut down due to X's enduring appeal. While Threads is backed by Meta, may still compete due to its integration with Instagram, other rivals face an uphill battle in convincing X users to switch platform, which we covered a little bit last week. Just the idea of what is it going to really take for people to leave Twitter? I did see another report saying that Meta is using that standpoint to try to bring users over to to Threads. No. It's just that stickiness factor, right? Like, is it enough
it's to just, get people to leave? They're different things. And I think, I mean, Threads is dead. You can just put up, like, it's going to go away. There's not a competitor to Twitter or X, and I don't think that there ever will be. I think it'll either just go away far, far off into the future, and just because of user behaviors or poor management or whatever. But Musk is by far, I think he's the greatest marketer of our generation, and I also think that what you're seeing in terms of the stats that people are looking at, you have to be careful about where people pull some of this information too, because if you look at some of the journalists and you look at the research, you'll notice that they're using like SimilarWeb, which is a Chrome extension, which the data isn't bad, but it's like you can't, especially whenever you're undertaking the process of maybe removing bots or there's just so many things that they're not accounting for. They're just looking at something to write a story about. I would guess that a big portion of the advertising drop off is due to the fact that the users, the impressions, all that kind of stuff are going to go down because they've removed a lot of users. A lot of those users are bots. I mean, it was ripe with bots. Don't believe what you've read. If you've read that there's more bots now or something, there were far more non-human entities interacting on Twitter than there were today. It's much more difficult today for that to occur. And the other thing that I think is interesting about this is the people that are active on Twitter appear to be more active than ever. But the reason why Twitter isn't going to go away is because you see it cited in news stories where it's like if you're reading about what Netanyahu said or Israel's stance on something right now, it's like they're quoting X, right? Like they posted on the platform. It's got that name appeal and it's official. It's also, Musk has done a fairly good job of making it as open as possible. And while the criticism comes from that, it also makes it so that literally, like you can have someone like Hamas or the Taliban like they post to Twitter. And, like it's basically like the UN rules where it's like you allow these people to represent because you don't want there to be an unrepresented country at the table, despite the fact that, maybe under normal circumstances, this is somebody that you wouldn't give a voice to. And so for that reason, it's a central position for news in the world. And I don't think that that'll change. I don't think that Meta can, I don't think there's a way to woo, like you think about what's it going to take for Meta to woo the Taliban to Threads?
True.
Right? Like, do you even want to try to do that?
No, I don't think they would even entertain the idea.
Yeah, if you clip any part of this, make sure that you like get that in context.
Good to know. Good.
What would it take for Meta to woo the Taliban? We go a lot of interesting places on here, but sort of that's my point with this is that with the Everything app and stuff like that, we've talked a little bit before about. I don't see the legal battlefield for that being one that is tenable. But I also imagine that over time, Twitter slash X or whatever it is, it might become more relevant. But I would say it's likely to remain a fixture of like what it is today. So if you're a publisher, it's like unless you're really making your hay on there or it's a relevant platform for you now. I don't imagine there being, it's not a new field of opportunity in my mind. And I think that it gets a lot of headlines, which to Musk's credit, but it hasn't changed its relevance in reality in several years.
No, and I think it's going to take either something big or Twitter just might kind of like go back on the incline and just start doing better in the next couple of years.
It's a weird platform because it's the only social media platform that's stayed like in the mix, but not number one for so long. Like most of them, it's either they peak and then decline, or they just sort of like they just kind of like peter along until they die. So it's so strange. It's probably the most unpredictable in that way.
What happened to MySpace? Why did people stop using MySpace? Do you remember the reason?
It was Facebook. Like one of the things that stockbrokers will look at is they basically pull like 12 and 13 year olds to ask them about their digital behaviors. And they'll basically like, so TikTok, like it's considered like safe for the next few years because it's still like the most popular like platform for like kids of that age. So one of the things that everyone learned with Facebook was originally it was only available at colleges. And once your college got, it was kind of a big deal because then it was this like closed social ecosystem. MySpace was everybody and Facebook was like just the kids at school, which there's a lot of reasons why you would kind of like want that. And I remember when my university got it that we were like amped and then, you know, everybody was on Facebook. And next thing you knew, it's like they kept opening it up and Facebook was the cooler one, right? And then eventually when everybody was on there, it kind of migrated everybody. It was really amazing how it happened. I don't necessarily know that it can happen like that again. Each sort of like social media iteration seems to be its own sort of departure from the last. Like you remember, how did TikTok become the dominant one? You know, it's like that's the most recent.
I mean, you could say that it kind of filled that void that Twitter left with Vine, right? People wanted short form content.
But the gap between Vine and TikTok was pretty significant, you know? It's more of like the evolution of Instagram. But like, you know, that bridge came via Snapchat. You know?
Interesting. And yeah, we've also seen that Snapchat has had an incline recently. It's been gaining users as of late. Now, personally, I don't use Snapchat, but it's interesting.
It missed me, you know?
Same. But it seems like it's starting to pick up a lot of steam. So we'll see how that kind of plays into the landscape of
social media. They've got an interesting story, and they've done a lot of things to make do with the fact that they've never really gotten the mass volume that, you know, that they promised or hoped for. But, you know, I'm amazed that I'll talk to people every now and then that are heavy users of it. They get their news from it. I remember a couple of years ago, this was a big thing in, you know, sort of like the enterprise, you know, digital advertising and publishing space was, you know, like you wanted to be a brand that was like basically putting stuff on Snapchat. Like I remember it might've been Hearst or one of the major publishing houses. They hired an entire like video team just to produce content for Snapchat. I remember a gentleman that spoke at one of our events talking about how they had an entire series or show in which it was just a series of stories of a, like it looked like a phone screen, but it was a group text chat between a group of like teenage girls. And that was like the show, is you just watch their text messages go back and forth via stories. It's a really interesting idea and it's engaging content. But yeah, it's like you're going to have to, Snapchat's going to have to really get some mass there before you're able to hit that niche well to support an entire video production team and stuff like that. And that's where it's like, I think in publishing, you have to be really wary about like investments and sort of like big leaps like that. Because I would say the same thing goes for if you're publishing into a niche sort of content or whatever. It's like, what leaps are you taking with your growth? And assuming where it's like, you know, critical mass, how big does it be? What is the investment there worth? And what is the investment worth to like maintain it? And Snapchat, to their credit, like they keep trying to find new things. I thought it might be wearables for a little while. Do you remember the spectacles?
I do remember those.
I bought some for my wife and she was like, these are the ugliest thing I've ever seen. Take them back, please.
Interestingly enough, a few weeks ago, Meta had their Oculus 3 reveal and they revealed a bunch of stuff, including AI integrated into their platform. And one of the things was that they were partnering with Ray-Ban to have glasses that have the camera, similar to what Snapchat did.
If you go and you look at like even like a Best Buy or something like that now, you'll find really good sort of like not necessarily augmented reality, but like recording based eyewear that looks like they do a great job of hiding those cameras. The thing that I think is that probably is the next, if I had to make a prediction on something that maybe is really disruptive in terms of like web content, I can tell you that a lot of the engineers and sort of people that are like sort of like building everything from games to content to movies to, you know, you name it, they're all very much focused on 3D. So 3D for the web. And that's going to be based around the fact that Apple's invested so much in this headset. And you have something like the Oculus 3. It's like, you know, I think people kind of got like burned out on this idea of virtual reality in the metaverse. But I think it's till we've had the chance to really put on those, the Apple headgear, or the Oculus 3. Because Apple, the vision goes right through it. Mm-hmm. So if you've ever put on AirPods and like you let the sound transform through, it's like, man, I don't even have these things on. It's like I'm hearing like how I, it's like these things have holes in it just to the outside. Imagine if that's also, you know, what you're seeing in front of you, where it's like, you know, you can have a screen or not, or you can see right through it. But if you look at the web right now, everybody, you can go to, I think it's 3D.js or 3THREE.js.com. And it's a JavaScript library, but it has a front end interface. So you can kind of mess with it like Figma or Photoshop, and you can design all kinds of cool stuff. They have all kinds of stuff that's already made, but it's for designing basically like a 3D web app site, you name it. But I think that there's a really good chance that that's a form of content that is very popular in the future. It's just, we're building the things now, but we just don't have the devices quite yet.
Yeah, definitely. Even Adobe has a lot of products where they have AR capability. So like even in Premiere, you can set stuff for augmented reality and VR and then export it for that. So we're starting to see a lot of companies integrate that kind of technology into their products to try to like slowly bring consumers into it.
Yeah. And if this is something that you'd like to try out, or just like even add elements of it to your site, or even just, you know, some images, or, you know, mess around with something, Spline is a free open source one. It's kind of like a Figma or a Canva for like making these 3D things. And if you want to start from somebody else's something that they've built, they have a community where you can just kind of like, you know, copy something that somebody has and just start working on it. But it's Spline. I think it's Spline. You can Google Spline. You'll find it.
Moving on to some AI news. We have a lot of AI news. So in a significant move towards responsible artificial intelligence, the G7, which includes Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, the US, and the European Union, has agreed to a voluntary code of conduct for companies involved in AI development. This 11-point agreement serves as a guiding framework to promote safe and secure, trustworthy AI technologies worldwide. It encourages organizations to adopt responsible practices and proactively assess and mitigate AI-related risks. This initiative has garnered support from leading AI companies and organizations, including Anthropic, Google, Microsoft, OpenAI, IBM, Meta, NVIDIA, and Palantir. Thank you. Who has already developed voluntary guidelines and pledged to prioritize safety and security in AI development, with President Biden's reportedly drafting an executive order, which he has done the executive order, to set AI standards for federal agencies. The United States is poised to play a key role in influencing AI companies to follow safe and secure practices with oversight from the Federal Trade Commission. With Joe Biden's recent executive order, he's going to be increasingly relying on ethical hackers for red teaming to uncover flaws in artificial intelligence tools. Biden's recent executive order mandates the development of red team testing rules by the National Institute of Standards and Technology and requires AI developers to submit red team safety results for government review before releasing new models. While red teaming has emerged as a crucial method to secure AI systems, experts warn that an exclusive focus on this approach may overlook other vital AI accountability mechanisms, such as algorithmic impact assessments and participatory governance.
It's a hard one sometimes.
Hey, English is my second language.
You kind of
got to
be on a roll with it, you know?
Exactly. These mechanisms are essential for addressing complex socio-technical AI harms, including algorithmic biases and fair AI model usage. Moreover, the scarcity of funding for AI security efforts beyond red teaming assessments raise concerns about the comprehensive assurance of AI accountability and safety. So it seems like there's a lot of suggestion, which kind of reminds me of the ESRB with video games back in the 90s, where Mortal Kombat was releasing games that were a little bit too violent, and a lot of people had a lot of issues with that.
I think so. This is all, most of this is all wrapped in sort of like a defense wrapper. So you notice the G7, the US, you know, these are all nations that are allied, and you know, like referred to in the East as the collective West. And I think that that's one of those things that like that seems to be a major concern of all world governments right now. It's like, who's innovating on AI, and then just sort of like, how much infiltration do other countries or other, you know, other competing nations have? Like, how far have they penetrated into our society, into our public? And it seems to be a concern because they're afraid of a lot of things. And the red teaming thing appears to be primarily focused on sort of like infiltrating infrastructure and also being able to like, get into, I mean, you think about something even like TikTok. I think that's the reason why you got pushed back there in the last year, is because it's like, well, wait a minute. This is a Chinese company that has clear ties to the CCP. And, you know, it's on the phones of, you know, a good number of our citizens. And it could potentially, you know, affect or impact public will, public discourse. So we see that as a risk. And now all of a sudden, if you have AI, which is exponentially sort of like penetrating into these things, you know, there does need to be a lot of testing, because not only do you want to be able to figure out how do you effectively use AI, and also figure out like how maybe you can break it or what kind of like things can go wrong. It's going to have to just be monitored. I mean, I don't think even the geniuses at something like Palantir are going to be able to tell you that, you know, this thing can run on its own. And be able to, you know, identify national security threats, or, you know, like even, you know, manage something like, financial fraud or whatever it is. So I see all of this as sort of like, more than anything else, it's the US doubling down on AI defense, along with pretty much every country right now. And then also the big tech companies that are leading in these areas, seeing it as a opportune time to sort of box out innovators and disruptors. There's one thing we know about regulation, and it's what, producer Manny?
It takes time to happen.
No, it just doesn't work. It makes big tech stronger. Something that we always talk about on the show, and I feel like it's just it doesn't seem to matter, because I don't know that the general public has enough expertise to know on any particular topic when, you know, you do have experts involved that are doing something effective versus not. But I think when it comes to tech, we can see it with the EU and GDPR in the US, and something like, or California and CCPA. It's like, these things are, you know, the lobbyists are that are writing these laws and working on them are largely, you know, they're at least impacted by big tech because they're the ones lobbying against them. So it's like, they sort of draw the ground rules, and then, you know, those are the rules then that, you know, people that maybe want to play on a different playing field are forced to play by, and that makes it much more difficult. But speaking of big tech, our good friends at Microsoft are rebooting, or retreading as they like to say, an old product. That product is PubCenter. It's really just kind of taking the place of something that has not worked very great for them, which is basically to like monetize your website using Microsoft ads from their display and native ads network. It's like a smaller, it's the Bing of AdSense. You know, I think most of our listeners will get that analogy. But producer Manner, anything groundbreaking here that I'm missing?
Well, in a strategic move to challenge Google's dominance in online advertising, Microsoft is relaunching its PubCenter platform, designed as a Google AdSense alternative. This relaunch, currently in the US only, is Microsoft's bid to woo small and mid-sized publishers, offering them an opportunity to monetize their websites with display and native ads from the Microsoft Advertising Network. This dates back to 2008. The PubCenter is being reimagined for today's digital landscape. Publishers can now select from various ad formats, easily integrate code into their websites, and start earning revenue for every ad served, all without any sign-up costs, revenue minimums, or volume increase or volume requirements. Microsoft is positioning PubCenter as a more lucrative option than Google AdSense, promising higher engagement and revenue. Moreover, it offers flexible mediation, allowing publishers to serve Microsoft ads alongside Google AdSense ads when there's a higher predicted bid.
So I'll stop right there just because, so before anybody's like, oh, should I try these ads or should I try these with AdSense? You should try them all. So this is the fallacy in ad networkism to begin with, which is that no ad network is the best one. There's not one that exists. You need to use them all. And this is why we invented ad servers, why they're back in the, this is like, you know, my issue with a lot of this is that the smaller publishers that, you know, maybe even just starting, like, or even just the mid-sized ones that have never had to, you know, navigate this stuff before, the biggest issue, this approach is, it's like, we're going to reinvent the wheel here, because next thing you know, people are going to be trying to do the old waterfall method where you try out which ad networks in which spots or whatever. It's like, this stuff got figured out a long ago. It's why you have the real-time bidding protocol. It's why you have things like ad exchanges, because you just want all these guys to compete with each other. And it's been done. So yeah, ad servers are the answer to everything. I think it's Microsoft's attempt to, you know, like, hopefully get people started with them as opposed to AdSense. We'll see. I mean, Microsoft is going to have to beat Google out in terms of audience network to do that. And I mean, we're a long way away from that. But speaking of things that are interchangeable, our product of the week this week is basically chatbots on your own website. So being able to add, you know, a chatbot to your website that can use content. There's a lot of these out there. I've used a handful. Most of them are really easy. They work off of RSS feeds, or you can literally just put a URL in. Some of them will crawl your sites. Direct AI, direct with a QT.ai is one. But you can also do this using OpenAI on your website. You may not want to build something and you go, ugh, it's scary. OpenAI.com, if you go look at the quick start for creating a ChatGPT chatbot, I bet you could do what, build your own in about 10 minutes. And you'd probably learn something along the way. And you'd be surprised at how easy it is. OpenAI has been made, their SDK, as they call it, software development kit, is incredibly simple. And so I would just say, if anybody that, you know, wants a challenge, I would say maybe try building this yourself first. I promise you can do it. But if not, there's any number of them out there, but the one that we'll talk about is the one that I've used, and then one that I think somebody else on our team used, which was DirectAI. But yeah, those are our tools for the week. And producer Manny, do you have anything else for everyone?
I just want to thank everyone for joining and watching the show this week. We look forward to seeing you guys next week. If you guys want to leave any comments, any suggestions, I'd love to know what made you leave MySpace and go to Facebook. And what will it take for you to leave Twitter?
What will it take for you to leave the publisher lab?
Nothing. They won't leave.
Never.
No.
No. All the money in the world could make me not listen.
Sometimes I listen for fun and I'm on the show.
It starts rolling when other podcasts finish, and I will listen to the whole episode on my phone sometimes just because I'm like, oh, that's an interesting point. I forgot I said that. All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll catch you next time on The Publisher Lab.